Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. Hey, so today we want to talk about the digital nomad lifestyle and how it relates to the tribal nomads that humans existed as for thousands and thousands of years before we invented agriculture.
Cool.
So I wanted to prompt you to maybe start with your own experience of how being a nomad changed your life and your perspective.
Okay. Well, for me, it became apparent when I was living in Vancouver, one of the more expensive cities in North America, that working my day job and trying to make my business grow was going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, with all of the demands of such a high expense city. And I was looking for all the other alternatives. And I picked up this book called The 4-Hour Workweek. And it really inspired me to what was possible and how you could leverage other types of things in your life, like location, where you hire, the type of work that you look for to increase your time freedom, your location freedom, and your financial freedom. And so this book really inspired me, and I ended up reading it quite a number of times, listened to it on audio form as well. And so eventually, after you and I met, we started an online business. We were doing website design. And got our first client and then took off to Thailand, bought a one-way ticket with very little money in the bank. And
sold everything we owned.
Yeah, that's right. Sold mostly everything. Gave our parents a little bit of stuff to keep, but mostly everything. And took off. And that was back in 2012. And we basically never stopped doing that. And I think what was really interesting along the way is how many people we met who were doing the same thing. That was super surprising to me, that there are people all over the world, our age at the time, and in many cases younger, who were going to these cheaper places to live where the lifestyle was actually much better, where they get a higher chance of meeting other like-minded people, because it's a self-selecting thing. Like if you are living in a place like Thailand or Vietnam, you're already of a mentality of going, you know, against the grain or doing something different, thinking differently. And then, you know, you also, in most cases, have to be working online. So if you meet another foreigner in a place like Thailand or Vietnam, you kind of know right away that they're already, they have more in common with you than the average person you might meet back home.
Mm-hmm. And so this was, you know, it was kind of a lifestyle decision at first, but what did you find was different in terms of how your mindset changed or how your experience of the world or of yourself changed when you started doing this?
Right. Good question. So, you know, after a while, we got some semi-stable income, recurring income, and a lot of it came from the people we'd met in Thailand. And you know, just other business owners, people like us. And once we started to get a little more income and stability and security, we started to hire a little bit more. And then we started to kind of work on getting our time back. And what happened when we got our time back was, you know, we instead of working 50, 60 hour work weeks to make ends meet, like I would have been doing back in Vancouver, I was able to hire, automate, outsource, and step a little bit further back and kind of think big picture about the business. And what that also did was allow me the time freedom to be able to read a bunch of books. And after, you know, cutting the work back and reading so many books over the years, that's really been the number one catalyst for sort of a big mental shift for me, has been, you know, taking that time and dedicating it to what my passions are, which is learning.
Other than learning, how did you notice your worldview shift, if at all, as a result of this kind of lifestyle.
Right. Well, I noticed a very distinct difference between the East and West, the ways of thinking. Looking back into the US and in Canada, I kind of had a different view about the way things worked, because I'd basically escaped what I had thought and other people had thought were just status quo, the way life is, the way life has to be. And, you know, living outside of that and really, you know, living outside of it, not just vacationing, not just visiting a place, but really, you know, your day to day for years is a different, very foreign kind of experience. And you get used to the foreign. And then when you look back at home, everything, it's home that is foreign suddenly. And so looking back at the West and the way people assumed certain things about the world and kind of had this self-centric, country-centric, like their own, they're within their own borders, they tend to act as if the whole world is like that. And one thing I really started paying a lot more attention to was the fact that the problems that people think they have and that are important on a global scale are really not very important. I mean, when you see people on a daily basis who have nowhere near the luxuries that we do in the West, not just in terms of material things or, you know, wealth or ability to have a nice place and get the kind of food that you want, but just rights and freedoms, ability to choose, having a good passport, a passport that allows you to travel. Like all of these things we in the West take for granted, and we kind of assume it's like that the rest all over the world, and it's really not. And so when I look back at the West, I think like there's a lot of babies and complainers. That's really what woke me up. I mean, I used to complain about a lot of the same things, like, oh, it's unfair that the, you know, my professor gave me this mark. It's unfair that, you know, I'm not getting as many hours this week at work. It's unfair that my landlord wants, you know, to do renovations and is evicting me. It's not fair that so-and-so died in a car accident. You know, there's any number of things. It's like, yeah. In any other context, though, in most other places in the world, those are daily occurrences, if not, I mean, privileges that people would love to have. Like, oh my God, you have a job to lose, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think also on the flip side, people in the West often assume that everywhere else in the world, or at least in the third world, in developing countries, things are just horrible. And people are just suffering all the time. And there's, you know, murder in the streets and corrupt governments. And they just imagine that they, their life kind of in the West is perfect. It's kind of paradoxical because on one hand, they complain a lot. But on the other hand, they're like, oh, those poor people over there in Africa, in developing countries. And they have this,
it works. I know exactly what you're saying. And it works in reverse, too, because a lot of people in the countries that we've visited have looked at America as like this land of opportunity, or Canada. It's all rich people there. And that's like super, super common perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not the case. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of people falling through, you know, the cracks of civilization and society. And
in Western countries, like in Canada and exactly. States.
And there's a lot of drug problems that doesn't exist in a lot of other countries that we visited.
Yeah, and vice versa. There's a lot of opportunity and development and, you know, happiness and fulfillment in so-called developing countries that people don't think exists, because people are incredibly adaptable creatures, and we just adapt to the environment that we're in, and, you know, kind of it becomes the new baseline. So people are able to find happiness and fulfillment everywhere in the world.
And I think what the West really does successfully, and I'm fairly critical of this, is it makes people focus on material wealth, accounting for their lives. You know, what do I have? How do I compare to other people? There's also this sort of boxing in of people, like even the way residential areas are built. It's like everything's a grid and everyone's got their own space, their own castle where they hoard all their stuff. And it's not any kind of communal, there's no shared spaces. We've talked about this before, and it's you know, it's probably one of the most isolating things is to live in a Western city. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the way Western cities are built, it's just nowhere near the kind of communal feeling as Europe or Asia.
I also want to differentiate between Western, saying North America and Europe, because the cities in Europe, at least the old ones, were built in a more kind of organic way and in a more communal way, where there's a lot of public squares or like hidden squares in between buildings where people can hang out and see their neighbors. And it's a very different feeling living in a city like that than in a grid-like city that just is devoid of any kind of humanness.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And still, though, I find this problem of isolation and bubble kind of thinking, like where people in, especially in Western Europe, get easily offended. There's still this like North American kind of or Western kind of attitude of censorship, of you can't say that, that people are very sensitive about anything to do with race or gender. And that's something that just simply doesn't exist in Eastern Europe and in Asia. Like you just can't, you would really struggle to find that. And I don't know what you say is better, because I mean, there's a lot of other issues in Eastern Europe and where we're living. You know, there's a lot of poor people, there's a lot of struggle, there's a lot of attitude kind of problems. There's sometimes problems with education and healthcare and these sort of things. But I would say in my experience, people are generally pretty happy.
I would say
young people. Yeah. Young people who are aware and have moved around are happy.
And so that kind of brings me back to the point of people who have moved around. Mm-hmm. I think it's difficult to say what is natural. And we've talked about this before, because humans are very adaptable, and we, you know, if we do something, we are obviously, you know, biological creatures. And if we do something, therefore, it's natural. Like, we are nature doing something. Mm-hmm. We're not separate from nature, as we like to imagine ourselves to be. So it's hard to say what's natural. But if we look at our evolutionary history, and if at least the, you know, the kind of consensus among anthropologists, and as Yuval Harari talks about in Sapiens, for a lot of the time in our history, we were nomadic tribes, and agriculture only comes around maybe 10,000 years ago. And so up until that point, we moved around a lot. So that was our normal daily experience.
Oh, yeah. And the book also mentioned how much more varied people's diets and sort of ability to think. Like there was a lot more kind of different tasks, and there's a lot more variation of tasks. Your brain, and that's where most of the evolution of our species took place, the rapid growth of our brains. It wasn't after agriculture, it was before. It was due to that sort of nomadic, you know, adaptable kind of human that we used to be and no longer are.
Yeah, there's actually some evidence that shows that our brains have shrunk.
Yep,
since I believe that. The invention of agriculture, and it's a very unsavory thing that people don't like to think about.
Yeah, I believe that. And and so, you know, back to the nomadism thing, I think since we sort of became nomadic,
personally, you and I.
Yeah, the variation in our lives is just insane. There's mm-hmm. just so much more challenge and opportunity and more interesting things to see. And every day is this like new kind of, well, it depends on how long you stay in a place. Like mm-hmm. Bulgaria is not feeling too new at the moment, but you know what I mean? Like,
we're definitely itching for a new adventure.
Yeah. But like, I would say the variation is what keeps you on your toes. Like the novelty and variation in your life is what keeps you adapting and keeps your brain working. And, you know, when you get stagnant in a single place, that's when everything seems to atrophy and feel worse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really easy also to get into kind of habitual ways of thinking.
Yeah.
Where you're not thinking outside of the box because everything is safe and familiar. And so you basically, you don't need to exercise that creative muscle anymore. And so you don't. Or you start exercising it in kind of more abstract ways that don't really mean anything, like just, you know, weird art or you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. I think that's perfectly normal expression of human creativity. But, you know, if like your whole life could be a creative exercise and, you know, challenging and interesting and fluid and all of it.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other things that I think make me extremely excited for the future when it comes to nomadism and the potential for people to be nomadic. I mean, more and more work is kind of moving online. There's more of a, I would say, a very, very early stage movement towards being able to pick the state that you pay your taxes in, that you, you know, get your health care from. There's a lot of more optionality and a lot more, I would say, in the future, probably be a lot more competition between services of countries, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, 'cause they want to attract intelligent people who bring value to the country. So they have to do certain things and they have to really double down on what they're doing well. For example, like there's a reason we're in Bulgaria, right? Like it's, the food is great. The people are interesting and different. And the walkability of the city that we live in is awesome. It's one of the biggest walking streets in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Nature is just mind blowing.
Yeah.
And the tax rate is low.
Yeah. Which is good. Then there's a lot of economic reasons to be here as well. The cost of living is very low. You know, you spend $5 at a dinner out, you
yeah,
know,
at a
it's
restaurant.
Like nothing. Yeah. At yeah. a fancy dinner too.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of economic reasons to be here.
Yeah. And a lot of other countries are starting to compete. They're starting to understand, that they need to kind of have an edge. And I mean, countries, states have done this for a long time. It's not a new thing. Like, you know, Switzerland obviously positioned itself as the banking destination a long time ago. And before that, states would attract people for different reasons. And now, you know, Singapore has some very attractive benefits for people wanting to start a business there. And they're attracting a lot of intellectuals as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that will increase even more in the future. And the city-state will become a more attractive option for people mm-hmm. rather than countries. Because countries are big and clunky and not very agile.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't adapt to change very quickly, but our world is changing very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So the smaller entities might become...
They really proved themselves not to get it either. I mean, remember when that visa thing kicked in Thailand, when there were so many entrepreneurs from Western countries hanging out in Chiang Mai, and all of a sudden, and this happened while we were there, one of the big co-working spaces got raided by the police because they had the understanding that people were there illegally siphoning money somehow out of the economy and basically just like living like kings and stealing from the locals. Instead of realizing that like how much value is actually being siphoned into the country. Most of us don't have clients or customers in the country, in Thailand, you know. All of our income comes from external places. And we hire locally sometimes, and quite a few actually do hire locally. We want our lifestyle to improve locally. So if there's services that we know of back home that aren't present, then we help locals to kind of start those new businesses. And then, I mean, there's so many examples of that in Thailand.
And people spend a lot of money, a lot more than locals. So they actually bring money into the economy.
So they're siphoning money from their country into the country they live in.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, but I mean, so my point was Thailand was just so slow to clue into this and had such a wrong idea about it. And then they raided all of these co-working spaces and tried to kick people out and realize, oh, actually everyone is legitimately here. There's no, like, there's nothing false about what they're doing at all.
They actually couldn't wrap their head around the concept of a co-working space. They thought that it was an office that was hiring foreigners to work for the company illegally.
Right.
Yeah, they couldn't,
right.
they were like, what? People pay to work here? Yeah. They pay to come to this office? They just like, I was getting a play-by-play from a friend, like posting about this in real time as they were held up there by the police. He's like, they just don't understand why we would pay to be here.
Yeah. 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 And there's some other issues too. I mean, living, I mean, I don't know. There's definitely give and take in being nomadic. Like,
oh, of course. There's so much risk.
Yeah.
There's unpredictability. You never know what kind of challenges you're going to run into. Like, visa problems are definitely a thing.
Yeah, there's problems with corruption and police. It's, I mean, I think there's a lot of corruption in Western countries, but it's more institutionalized.
Yeah.
In places in the East, it's kind of like there's an understanding, if especially if you're there long term, like you probably get pulled over by the cops, you know, several times per month. And I call it driving while white, because they just spot me out as a foreigner and they pull me over and say, you know, something's wrong with your bike. And I'm like, no, nothing's wrong with the bike. You just stopped me because you thought you can get a bribe. But I know the drill, so I just annoy the hell out of them until they send me on my way. And a friend of ours actually pretended he had diarrhea. Shout out to you, John.
Yeah, to get out of paying cops a bribe, they're like, oh, get out of my face.
Yeah, you just like hold his stomach and then he start undoing his belt and just like pull it down. And then they're like, oh my God, send this guy away. Go. We do not need this guy shitting all over the street. That was a good pro tip.
Yeah.
Travel pro tip. Yeah, so I mean, you face a lot of different problems, but I would say the cost benefit ratio is very much in our favor. You know, I mean, building this studio, building a podcast, having like, and having actual opportunity to work on it, because we're not living a life
in the rat race in a 9-to-5.
Exactly. Like, yeah. I don't have to work a part-time job to make this work.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing.
But it's definitely a completely different mindset. Like, you just have to break your conditioning and rebuild from scratch. They're on so many different levels.
Yeah. What kind of conditioning would you say?
Well, first of all, the expectation that somebody owes you something. Whether it's an employer that owes you a job or owes you benefits or owes you payment on time, or if it's the government that owes you, you know, security or
healthcare. Radical self-responsibility.
Anything. It is totally a mindset of radical self-responsibility. And it can go wrong in so many more ways, because we're all human and we forget stuff. And, you know, like sometimes we're tired or don't feel like doing something and nobody's there to hold your hand. And
Yeah, when you have no schedule, the alarm clock doesn't need to even exist. It's like, yeah, you can waste a lot of time for sure.
Yeah, and you have to learn how to motivate yourself and how to meet your own needs, because you're not plugged into a system that meets those needs for you.
Yeah.
You know, like, you don't go out to a local pub every Friday night because that's the routine. Like, you have to actually go out and seek out the people that you want to hang out with and make that effort. And otherwise, just your social life is not going to happen.
Yeah. I think probably the bigger leap is just going from having a job to being a freelancer or being an entrepreneur. Like, that's a complete change in thinking for most people. And when people ask us about what we do, that's like, that's the number one thing they seem to be most confused about or most shocked by. Oh, you just run your own business and travel.
When we say we have a podcast, they're like, oh, do you like work at a studio that like hires you to do these podcasts? No, we just do our own thing.
Yeah. So what are we trying to do here? Like, you know, convince people to do this or what?
Well,
I think the nomadism thing is the real, like, you know, shiny object here, especially after reading the book Sapiens. And the variation of lifestyle and diet and culture and all of this stuff being so stimulating for the brain. And then the other element of getting time back, I would say it's, you know, if we could all collectively move in that direction in the future, I would say it would have huge cascading effects on government, on policy, on lifestyle, on conflict, on so many different things, because people would be more globally minded, global citizens, instead of stuck in their borders. And they would probably pay a lot more attention to what's going on.
Well, my argument would be this, that the reason why we became sedentary, where we started living in one location, was because we had to take care of crops.
Mm-hmm.
But now the majority of people are not farmers. So we just seem to have this inertia of where we built these cities around agriculture, and then it turned into industry, and it kind of, you know, snowballed on itself. But now there's no reason for us to live in the same location all the time, because, you know, jobs are moving online. We are not farmers. So we don't have to do this anymore. And there's, as the book Sapiens talks about, there are actually quite a lot of both physical and mental health problems that people get from living in the same place.
Really?
And living indoors, and well, first of all, living indoors all the time, spending all your time sitting, is horrible for your back. It's bad for your eyes. It's bad for your breathing. Like, it's bad for your skin. There are just so many health problems from living indoors. And then, of course, there's the, you know, the kind of food that we eat because of our lifestyle, where, you know, we don't get variety. We get food.
You got to specify who you mean by we here.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like, not us.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, the kind of the status quo of Western life.
Yeah.
Basically, there are so many things in the way that Westerners live that are really, really unhealthy. And now there's the compounding problems with technology, where people are addicted to social media and to porn and, you know, on being online all the time. And basically, it's not even a controversial opinion that I think our whole society is sick.
Mm-hmm.
And something has to give. And yeah. I'm not even talking about the existential risks and the problems of overconsumption that are causing, you know, climate catastrophe. And if, you know, all this overconsumption is being driven by the kind of inertia of the Industrial Revolution and all the businesses that are trying to get profit. They're not actually interested in keeping a population healthy or keeping the planet sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So something has to change.
Another interesting thing that I picked up from that book is the attitudes towards child rearing in a nomadic society versus an agricultural society. I mean, I can't remember exactly why, maybe you remember, but there's definitely a lot more of a push towards having a lot of kids all at once in an agricultural society. And when you're nomadic, maybe it's simply because the option is there.
Because they could, yeah.
Yeah, because they could. So when you're nomadic, you can't spread out your energy towards multiple kids. You know, you can't be nomadic and have four kids in tow and be able to provide for them. So they space their kids out over a lot of years. You know, every 4 years they might have a child. And so it gave them an opportunity to put a lot of attention into one child, and then that child could become moderately self-sufficient by the time they had the second child. And then the first child could help raise the second child along, you know, and the family unit just got stronger over time. Whereas now, I can't tell you how many of my friends back home are just feel that rush to have all the kids right now. And I think it's partially because of the level of isolation in the West, you know, with our boxed homes and everything and kind of scheduled play dates and everything, that you know, as a parent, that your child is going to have most of their time either by themselves indoors or with siblings. There's not going to be a lot of real opportunity to go out with a whole bunch of kids aside from regimented school kind of situations. And so I think there's a bit of a rush to have them all at once. You want the kids to be the same or close to the same age so they can play with each other. And that's one thing I thought about more recently, since we are really trying to figure out what we want to do in the long term, where we want to be based and where we want to have kids and stuff. It's like really difficult to sort this stuff out in our kind of lifestyle when you have the same expectations of having all the kids at once. Mm-hmm. But after reading that book, Sapiens, I have redefined what I want out of raising kids. And it's more now about like spacing them out,
yeah,
and letting them interact as much as possible, get them outside, you know,
yeah,
go play, go meet some other people, some other kids and play.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden the pressure is way off of us, right? Like we don't have to just have all of our shit sorted out immediately. We don't have to have a home base necessarily perfectly sorted out because every child is going to get like a 4-year span of attention.
Yeah.
From us.
And then there's the problem with the education system, which we've talked about before, that it prepares people to be little robots and, you know, to succeed in the corporate ladder rather than be self-sufficient or think for themselves or anything like that. So, you know, if we're not living in the same location all the time, then how does schooling happen? Well, you know, if the traditional school system isn't really suitable to get people to kind of be creative and to self-actualize and learn to kind of, you know, hone their gifts rather than just fit into a box, then what does an education system of the future look like?
Yeah, this is another standard way of thinking, an assumption about education that I can't help but challenge now after traveling. I mean, my post-high school life of education has only had to do with music and audio production. And it wasn't like I went to university and studied something deep and got into a profession. Like I started my own business, and anything I studied officially could have been left behind. Like I could have taken it or leaving it. On the other hand, my desire to learn and the willingness to take courses and read books and you know, really set my own curriculum and voraciously learn has been critical to our success over the years. And that's something that I just can't help but think about the standard education systems as being detrimental rather than helpful, setting people up for that kind of factory line work that doesn't exist anymore. Memorization of facts, getting good at, you know, beating test scores and not really focusing on results or real application of what you're learning in real life. How many young people today don't know how to cook a meal, don't know how to do their taxes, don't know how to buy a plane ticket properly and plan a travel schedule, just so many practical life things because school never bothered to teach them any of that.
Not to mention how to run your own business or...
Oh, yeah.
For yourself.
I've taken one single, like 2 or 3 week course on entrepreneurship, and it was so irrelevant and unhelpful. That, like, everything is just on the go, learn as you go. So I guess my point really is, like, the education system is another thing that gets the assumptions about the education system is another thing that gets turned on its head when you've been traveling around. You realize, well, the skills we've had to learn have nothing to do with standard education.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I've been thinking about this, how long-term travel, being a digital nomad, is kind of a form of initiation. Because an initiation kind of like breaks your current worldview and assumptions and pushes your limits and then creates something new where you're transformed as a result. And long-term travel does the same thing, where it just flips all your assumptions on their head. And over time, you know, through struggle and trial and error, you figure out how to do it differently. But it's definitely an initiation type experience.
Yeah. I suppose as for its usefulness, it really depends on the type of travel.
Mm-hmm.
That's critical, I think. Vacation does not count. Living is what counts, and you know, it's not really a common opportunity.
No, it's not. It isn't. It's something that has to be chosen at every point of the path. it seems, and it has to be chosen over and over and over. Because we know lots of people who did a stint of living in Vietnam or Thailand for a year, and then they went back.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe they go to Bali every winter for a few months, but then they're still based in the US. So that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And it a lot of people definitely can't handle it in the long run. And there are downsides to it. I think one of them is loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Not having a stable community where everybody is transient, and then you don't have a whole lot in common with the locals. So it can definitely get pretty lonely.
On the other hand, I keep thinking and I keep, you know, remembering every time how much I have in common with young people. I mean, it's like we have more in common in younger generations because of the internet and because of global culture and shared memes and shared jokes. I mean, anyone can be on Reddit or YouTube and see the same things no matter where they are on the planet. And everyone, for the most part, most people have a cell phone and have access to the internet out there. So it's like, I find we have a lot more in common with people anywhere in the world if they're just of that generation who is actively, who's born into the internet and actively using it. The generation gap, or what we have in common gap between people in the countries that we visit who are of a certain age is vast. It's what people, I think, expect travel to be. The cultural differences are huge, but it's just not, it's simply not the case with young people. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm making friends lately with people who speak very little English, but know all the same jokes, you know? Like, lately I've just been making one friend and we just joke around, you know, every day and just try, there's such a struggle to try and understand each other, but when you get it, it's like, it's a lot of fun because all the same references are understood. If he tried to do that with, you know, my parents, or I tried to do that with his parents, it wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, it seems that there's kind of an emergence of a global hive mind with young people.
Totally. Exactly. And this is what gets me mostly excited about the future is this is a complete paradigm shift that's just a time bomb. Like, it's just waiting to go off. You know, the older generations die and get older, and the younger generations take over. And we just haven't had, they're not old enough yet, you know, to really make much of a difference.
Or I would say that it's partially that the older generation has still quite a stronghold on the power structures. Mm-hmm. And because they own a lot of those structures.
Mm-hmm.
And the young generation, I do think they have a lot of power, but they just don't realize it yet.
Yeah.
Because who controls the narrative controls the power a lot of the time.
Yeah, but I mean, no one controls narrative anymore. That's the funny thing. Like, do you think people who are spending, like, what kind of media do young people consume the most of? They're not on TV. They're not on CNN. They're not on BBC. They're not on Fox News. They're on YouTube. They're on Reddit. They're on Twitch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're getting their information from much more varied sources. Although they do have the possibility of creating echo chambers, but it's nothing like what happens in broadcast media.
But the old power structures do have their tentacles in the new media formats, for sure. You know, with all the fake news and the Twitter bots and, you know, the Facebook viral articles that are obviously propaganda.
Yeah.
So it's getting infiltrated and it's getting very, very difficult to understand what is true and what isn't. I don't think we've reached a technological singularity yet, but I do think we're living through a social singularity right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody really understands what's going on.
Right. Yeah, it's very true. I think we should probably wrap it up here.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you wanted to say?
I think my main interest in talking about this was just to present a different version of reality or a different narrative that we have been living that exists. Not to say that it's better or perfect or without its challenges, But I remember before I became a digital nomad, I didn't realize that this kind of thing was possible. And then only by reading the 4-Hour Workweek did I realize that, oh, actually, there are other people doing it. Mm-hmm. So
I can't really say enough about what has happened from the time freedom that has come with this and the ability to just reflect.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the most critical thing. And if you can just figure out a way to get a little bit of your time back and then be taken out of your cultural context, you know, family, friends, you know, the environment that you're in, and exist somewhere else and study something important to you, that's where all of this really takes off. That's where all of this is most interesting. And I mean, you don't have to do what we do necessarily to get that. You could get that locally. You don't necessarily have to travel, but I'm just saying, to me, the most valuable thing has been the time to reflect. That's number one. And if I could give anything to everyone else, to anyone listening to this, that would be the thing. Not necessarily the variation of culture and, you know, the plane tickets and whatever. It would be figure out how to get some time away from your normal life, extended amount of time, and, you know, take some courses, read some audiobook, or read some ebooks and audiobooks.
Yeah. I would say that for me, the two most valuable things have been flipping what I thought was the status quo on its head. And it happened when I moved from Russia to Canada, but then it happened again when we left Canada to be digital nomads. And how it's not just one thing, because when one kind of narrative or status quo aspect of your life gets flipped on its head, it makes you reflect on everything else. You're like, oh, what other things am I assuming are true that aren't? And it just makes you think about everything in your life. And then you start noticing it everywhere, that there's just all these assumptions that people are operating on that are just fairy tales. Mm-hmm. They don't exist. So that's the first thing. The second thing is learning to live with uncertainty.
Oh, and yeah.
this is actually a huge, hugely important skill that I think is going to be really important going forward into the future, because the world is changing so fast and nobody really understands what's going on, that I think being comfortable with uncertainty and being able to function in it is going to be a really, really important skill going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I take for granted how scared people are and how kind of normalized this has become for us, but how, you know, the risk-taking behavior that has been required to do any of this stuff has probably been a lot higher than average. I don't know really what to say about that. It's so normalized now. Like, there's very little. I think one thing you realize, like, there are definitely downsides, but things are never as bad as you think they're going to be. And with uncertainty doesn't mean, you know, everything will fail and collapse and be the worst it could possibly be. Like, the worst outcome is you can steer, you know, whether or not you know something is going to work perfectly, you can still steer it along the way. So, you know, trusting it a bit in your willingness and ability to adapt and do what is necessary and fix problems as they pop up and, you know, move to where you want to go. That's relying on yourself to do that has been such a fulfilling and growth kind of activity for me, that there's no going back. Like, there's nothing that could possibly entice me to go back.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. It's been fun.
All right. See you. This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.
Thanks for tuning in to Future Thinkers. For all the books, resources, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/68. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.